This is BCFM.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. King Mervyn is retiring, but is Dracula taking over at the Bank of England? While the BBC and others drone on about Mark Carney's role as the Governor of the Bank of Canada, they avoid any mention of his much more important role on the board of the Central Bankers Central Bank in Switzerland. I'm talking about the Bank for International Settlements. Mark Carney's chairing two groups as part of the BIS, one to stabilise the currencies of the world and the other to draw up policy for the central banks. Neither is working. Anyway, the first investigation into the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland, Adam Libor's Tower of Basel, has just been published, and it makes for pretty frightening reading. The bank provided a lifeline to Hitler in the 1930s, helping fund his arms build-up, and through the war to provide the Nazis with much-needed foreign exchange, which they couldn't get anywhere else. Also, 6 months on, I catch up with Filton aircraft engineer John Hart, who's managed to find a farm to carry on his work since he was kicked out of his Filton hangar by owners BAE Systems when they closed the airfield. And he tells me not everyone has been so lucky. Also, have you had enough of shouting at the TV, like me, and radio when they talk rubbish? Well, enough of that. Luke Radowski from New York founded We Are Change, which uses the internet to doorstep the war criminals, the banksters, and others the mainstream media fail to do. But before all that, our little tour around the world's hotspots with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, you're flagging up the Middle East as usual. What is it specifically this week?
Well, I'm afraid that the war in Syria is spreading into Lebanon, quite deliberately so. The FSA, Free Syrian Army, have been operating inside Lebanon just as Hezbollah have been operating inside Syria. And of course in Iraq we've got we hardly hear anything about Iraq these days, but the government of Iraq is aligned with Assad in Damascus, and they've got their own Sunni insurgency to deal with. And the real danger here is that everything is going to topple over into a major war this summer.
Who would be the protagonists in such a war then?
Well, the protagonists at the moment are the two local teams, if you like, the pro-Iranian team and the pro-Saudi team, if you can call it that, the Saudi-Israeli team, because of course it looks as if the extreme Sunni Muslim jihadis are being assisted by Western protégés and cutouts like the Turks and the Qataris.
Now, when you say cutout, what do you mean?
Well, I mean that William Hague was in the House of Commons the other week saying that Britain is deciding whether to arm the rebels in Syria or not. Meanwhile, our allies, who we arm and train already, the Qataris and the Turks, have already decided they're going to arm and train them, and they are. So, in other words, we're already doing it. Meanwhile, we're having a discussion about whether we might do it. In actual fact, it's already been decided. Opinion polls in the US show up to 70% of people opposed to it, but in actual fact, it's already happening. So when they say, should we do this, it's not, should we do this next? It's, we're already doing it. We're only asking you, should we do this, because we're already doing it. And that's the reality.
Meanwhile, tens, if not hundreds of thousands, in Brazil, millions on the streets, in some various countries. Yep. We're talking about Egypt, which isn't really being reported. Yep. Bulgaria.
Yep. There's a big demo in Egypt on Sunday.
Hundreds of thousands of people on the streets against their government there. And of course, in Turkey, an ongoing battle, really, between many ordinary people in Turkey and the government.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously each of these situations is specific. I mean, people in the streets look the same in one way, wherever they are, but of course the demands are different and the political situation in each of these countries is different. For example, in Brazil, the response of Dilma Rousseff, who's the female president, has been very supportive of the demonstrators, saying, please don't smash the place up, you've got a right to demonstrate. They were demonstrating about bus fares, so they've made a decision that they're not going to increase bus fares and so on. So in Brazil, you've kind of got a dialogue going on between the Workers' Party government and the demonstrators. In Turkey, you've got more of a split between secular and Islamist forces in the society, and it's not clear who in fact has more force. Same in Egypt, you've now got, you know, half the population quite secular, half the population quite Islamist. Now in Turkey and Egypt, some kind of resolution has to be found which doesn't lead to civil war. I don't think you're going to see civil war in Brazil, because the government is in fact listening to the demonstrators, many of whom voted for them.
I mean, for example, in Egypt, clerics today are warning of civil war as there's a rivals clash, that is massive demonstrations against the Muslim Brotherhood and massive demonstrations for them. This is Reuters. Egypt's leading religious authority is warning of civil war today and calling for calm as political factions are clashing ahead of major rallies. The opposition's hopes can force the Islamist president to quit. A member of the ruling Muslim Brotherhood was shot dead also overnight.
Yeah, I mean, in Turkey, I think the situation is clearer, because Erdogan did win an election. He's won the last three elections. Morsi, there is rumours that in fact he didn't win the election, that the army packed the ballot boxes for him. Now, if that's the case, those who are opposed to him have got a case for him to go. And I'm not saying I can say for sure what the situation is here, but in both countries, one would hope for restraint. Otherwise, it's going to be Syria all round, isn't it?
So also in Turkey, security forces are firing on the protest in the southeast of the country, and one person's dead. I mean, what is going to be, do you think, the outcome here? Because there seems to be genuine popular uprising and the governments simply aren't listening. There was at least an attempt in Brazil for the government to address some of the issues, particularly really saying, okay, we won't. One of the reasons people were protesting is because the government were trying to reform the constitution. They've now said, oh, we won't reform that. So that at least calms the people out on the streets. There seems to be an increasing disconnection in many countries around the world between the leadership and ordinary people. What is going on?
Well, there's a disconnection because the leadership are actually answerable to the power centres of the world, you know, the Wall Street, the City of London, the Pentagon. But at the same time, they've got to keep their own key people quiet. I mean, in Turkey, most people are totally opposed to Turkey's position of supporting the rebels inside Syria. But Erdogan is doing it because he likes the rebels inside Syria. They're on his side of the political fence, but also the Americans are encouraging him to do it. But in fact, it's not very popular inside Turkey. In Egypt, the situation is different again. I mean, one hopes that people show restraint, that's all, because otherwise you can end up with a situation like Syria, which has basically fallen, and Iraq, which have fallen into sectarian civil war, a bit like Bosnia, but on steroids. And, you know, people have just got to show some common sense. People have got different views, and there's going to be political changes. The situation in Brazil, I think, is far more hopeful, because you've basically got a kind of, you know, a meaningful dialogue going on. But elsewhere, of course, the problems are more intractable because the situation is just different and more complicated.
In that old chestnut, Iran, NBC News is reporting today an ex-Pentagon general is the target of a leak investigation. Legal sources told NBC News the former second-ranking officer in the US military is now the target of a Justice Department investigation into a politically sensitive leak of classified information about a covert US cyber attack on Iran's nuclear program. So it seems that it's okay to do these kind of covert attacks on Iran's nuclear program. The real crime is speaking out and saying to the public that it's happening.
Quite so. In an actual fact, if you look at the introducing viruses into other people's nuclear programs is A, irresponsible, and B, totally illegal. So anybody who was involved in that, whatever level of the government in the US was involved in signing that off, including possibly Obama, you are criminals. And in actual fact, what should happen, whether you're elected or not, is you should go to prison. And if it doesn't happen, we're going to war. And war is not what you think it is.
Well, certainly that looks as if it's going to be the way in Syria, whether these peace talks in Geneva happen or not. The Americans are saying that they expect to have arms in the hands of the Syrian rebels, US arms, within a month.
Yes, and of course that's the point is that...
Through the CIA, by the way, this is the American...
Yes, and they've been doing it all along, so when they say, shall we arm them, this is all very silly, because they've basically been arming them all the time. What happens, of course, is that they arm the extreme jihadists, and then say, oh, look, these extreme jihadists are taking over. This is exactly what happened in Mali. These extreme jihadists are taking over. Oh, they're taking over from Libya, where we've just encouraged these people to take over, and now they're taking over Mali. That's why we've got an excuse to invade Mali. And of course the Russians are wise to these kind of tricks. They've pulled a few of them themselves in the over the years, and we're reaching a situation where the Russian and Chinese leaderships are finally deciding that they're going to draw a line in the sand. So when we were talking about who these two teams going to be in the Middle East, well, it could be Shanghai Cooperation Organization versus NATO, which is basically World War III.
Okay, well, not okay, but one of the problems, of course, which has come out after the Edward Snowden's revelations about the National Security Agency and these massive PRISM surveillance program that's been going on by the National Security Agency and GCHQ, sharing data, basically, you know, almost everything that's flying around on the internet is being scooped up by these computers and stored, even though it's private information. I had a look at to see what Sir Malcolm Rifkind, who's in charge of overseeing the intelligence services, that's GCHQ, MI5 and MI6, and probably others too that we don't necessarily know about, and it turns out that he's actually working for a company called LEK. Sir Malcolm Rifkind is chairman of LEK's European Advisory Board. Now this company is involved with offering aerospace and defence clients services, strategic planning, facilitating strategy development with management teams, gathering and analysing competitor intelligence, but also some fairly sharp paying stuff, Martin. I mean, to do with missile systems and this kind of thing. So, I mean, for somebody in that position who's a former defence minister, I think he was also foreign secretary as well, I mean, shouldn't he actually be distancing himself from actually putting money in his pocket from defence companies when he's supposed to be overseeing the intelligence services?
Well, I would agree with that, and I think most people with a rational approach would agree with it. In actual fact, if we're going to produce weapons, they should be produced by the government, in other words, by nationalised industries, and there shouldn't be any pecuniary interest involved at all, and therefore there's no temptation for politicians to pad their future nests when they leave office, because there's no padding to be done if it's all produced under social, you know, as social production.
I mean, this company, LEK, I'd never heard of them, but they bring to bear their considerable experience, it says on their website, or at least it did, I don't know if that's still there, and commercial expertise to help companies across the breadth of the defence sector. Satellite and missile systems, they do security and also systems integration and electronic warfare. Now, this sounds very much like the sort of stuff that the intelligence services do. So, I mean, how can he, you know, say that he's actually looking after the public interest when he seems to be... Well, he's taking money from these defence-related firms.
Yes, and it makes you wonder why, when he was in office as Foreign Secretary, how much influence was over his decision-making was made by the fact that he knew he was going to end up working in this industry when he left office. And, of course, it begs the question, doesn't it?
Well, the Intelligence and Security Committee is what is there to oversee the security services and GCHQ and the Secret Intelligence Service. That's MI5, MI6 and GCHQ. All the money that we spend on them being looked at by these people. So who else is on there? Let's have a look. Malcolm Rifkind is the chair of it. Then you've also got the Right Honourable Hazel Blears MP, which many people will know. She was a former Home Secretary under Labour. Then someone called Lord Lothian, who's a QC, and he's otherwise known as Michael Ancram. He was a founding signatory in 2005 of the Henry Jackson Society Principles, advocating a proactive approach to the spread of liberal democracy across the world, including, when necessary, by military intervention. So it seems also that he's an advocate of possibly of these kinds of regime changes, Martin, that we've been seeing recently. It does seem that you've got a fairly hawkish Intelligence and Security Committee with people like Michael Ancram, Lord Lothian in it as well.
Well, yes, I mean, it's a revolving door, isn't it? The links between senior members of both major political parties on the arms industry really needs to be questioned, because of course ultimately they're making money out of peddling arms, but arms eventually get used. And when we work back from World War III, I was talking about World War III earlier, if it happens, the historians will have to work back, well, how did that come about? It came about because we allowed our politicians to get completely corrupted by the arms industry.
Another member of the committee, not necessarily corrupt, so just better point that out, the Right Honourable the Lord Butler of Brockwell. Well, in February 2004, it was announced that Lord Butler of Brockwell would chair an inquiry into the use of intelligence in the lead-up to the 2003 Iraq War. His report, widely known as the Butler Report or Butler Review, concluded that some of the intelligence about Iraq's possession of weapons of mass destruction was flawed. The report also concluded, in regards to the so-called Niger uranium forgeries, that the report Saddam's government was seeking uranium in Africa appeared well-founded. Well, that's simply been proved total nonsense. So this guy also seems as if he's spinning for the intelligence services, Lord Butler.
Yes, but I mean, what they're trying to do is have a judge, a Labour politician, a couple of Tory politicians, and it looks as if it's a full house of people who are going to be open-minded. But in actual fact, as we well know, the military-industrial complex basically controls this country. The city and the military-industrial complex, that's who runs Britain.
Yeah, but has the military-industrial complex actually hand-picked these people? The ones I've read are all, it seems, very, very close to that, and also have been spinning for them, and actually, making public pronouncements in public positions, which have later been proved to be false, which are pro the intelligence services.
Mm, they haven't got Dennis Skinner on there, have they? Or anybody like that?
No,
surprisingly enough.
They certainly haven't.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
The British Prime Minister has appointed the most committed Zionist as the Trade Minister. David Cameron has appointed one of the most outspoken supporters of the Zionist regime in Israel as Trade and Investment Minister. Media in Britain reported, this is the Iranian Press TV here, the Ian Livingstone, 48, who heads telecom giant BT as Chief Executive, will take up the new job in December. He's called the Israeli entity as the most amazing state in the world. He's replacing Lord Green, an ordained priest in the Church of England, which is a bit of a joke since he was involved at HSBC Bank chairing it when they were doing money laundering, who's approaching retirement. It's reported that Cameron personally handpicked Livingstone for the Trade Minister job, saying that he will bring huge talent to a vital national effort. The Prime Minister once moaned the UK's Conservative Party should be called the Torah Party rather than the Tory Party because there's so many Israeli Jews at the top of it. Now, this is Press TV reporting, Martin, but it is a bit worrying that there seems to be this pro-Zionist, pro-Israeli political bias. Not a lot of room for the Arab view.
No, and I think that's... We're talking neoconservatism here, the sort of Liam Fox faction. And it's very dangerous, because, of course, Britain ought to be seen to be even-handed in these things, but patently we are not. We are not seen as the good guys. All over the world, people see us as bullies and terrorists, and by and large, they're right.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Okay, moving Antipodean now. Julia Gillard has been defeated by Kevin Rudd in a leadership challenge over in Australia. Can you just tell us a bit about some of these figures, Martin?
Well, to be honest with you, I find this quite difficult to follow because it seems that a lot of it is very personalised. Rudd opposed Australia's involvement in the Iraq war, and he's a former diplomat. But he was removed by Gillard, who was the first woman prime minister, and she has come in, frankly, for an awful lot of sexist abuse from the right wing in Australia, who just don't like the idea of having a woman in charge. And the Labour Party is now having a bit of a convulsion about who should lead them into the election in September. Let's hope they can, from my Labour point of view, let's hope they can mend their fences and win in September.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, was Michael Hastings' car hacked? Richard Clark says it's possible, and this is about a journalist, Michael Hastings, whose death in Los Angeles week before last have unleashed a wave of conspiracy theories. Martin, who was this guy, Michael Hastings?
Well, he used to work for Rolling Stone magazine, and his most famous, he's only 30-something, and his most famous article was about General McChrystal, who he was talking to in some kind of airport lounge while they're having a few drinks, and McChrystal was being very uncomplimentary about Obama, and he basically wrote that up, and McChrystal lost his job. McChrystal, in fact, I think is a war criminal. He's a sort of death squad running type chap. You know, remember this uncovered recently by The Guardian that they were running all these death squads in Iraq. He was part of that. So in actual fact, him bad-mouthing Obama is the least of his crimes. But he was also, I mean, the Hastings said to his friends that the FBI were investigating him. He'd approached WikiLeaks the previous week, and then suddenly has a very, very suspicious car crash involving
what
looks like a bomb almost, you know.
What do you mean by a suspicious car crash?
Well, the car crash is not just a car crash. The car blew up. Yeah, it hit a tree and then blew up.
Well, some cars do.
Yes, indeed they do. But a lot of people are asking questions about this.
The most suspicious thing about it is he's been cited by several people as someone that used to tootle around very slowly in his car, and he was filmed doing something like 70, 80 miles an hour in an urban area, and it looked like his car was totally out of control. One of the other articles I saw had a little freeze frame from the police video of the car going past, and it looked as if he had his foot on the brakes, even though the car was doing something like 70 miles an hour in an urban area. The police then followed him, and then they came to the crash scene. But what about this technology? Because what many people are saying is it is actually possible with some of the most modern cars to hack into the electronic management system of the car, basically shut down the brakes, shut down the accelerator switches, and take over control of the car. In other words, so you're going fairly fast, but what it does is it means that the car accelerates at a massive pace. When you put your foot on the brakes, nothing happens.
Yeah, a bit like the planes flying on 9/11, which look as if they've been flown from the ground by somebody who get hacking into the electronics.
What's the principle behind the idea of hacking into the electronics?
Well,
like
if you think about it for a minute, if you've got complex electronics in a car or in a plane, that complex electronics can be hijacked, just as your computer can be hijacked. And of course, old-fashioned cars, where the brakes really you had to put, it was the pressure of your foot on the brake which causes the brake to act. That's more complicated. You can snap the brake cable or whatever. But I mean, who would you think would have the technology to sort of hack into cars and crash them into things? I suggest it's the intelligence services, isn't it? Who else?
Well, also, I can remember there was quite a lot of problems with the Toyota cars over the last couple of years, where people had found that this sort of thing had happened, where because there's an electronic connection between the accelerator and the engine, you know, if anything goes wrong with that, there's actually no direct way of stopping a car accelerating at maximum speed. If you're, for example, on a motorway, the car just carries on going faster and faster, and people have found that they can't actually slow the damn thing down. I mean, this is really potentially very, very dangerous, isn't it?
It is, but if you think about 9/11, you've got these planes flying around in US airspace, but they don't fly directly to the targets. They actually fly very bizarre looping runs where they change direction several times. Now, that looks prima facie evidence to me that these planes are being flown from the ground by Global Hawk technology, which of course the US flew an airliner from the US to Australia in the early 70s without any pilot at all. If you think, and what are drones as apart from pilotless planes? So the technology really does allow these things to be hacked into. Yeah, once you've electrified the technology to a sufficient degree, then that technology can be hacked by whoever.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Well, Mark Carney is about to take over the Bank of England, and the first investigation into his real employer, that is the Bank for International Settlements in Basel in Switzerland. Adam Libor's book, The Tower of Basel, has just been published, and it makes for frightening reading. The bank provided a lifeline to Hitler in the 1930s, helping fund his arms build-up, and through the war was providing the Nazis with much-needed foreign exchange. Well, I spoke to Adam about the new governor of the Bank of England and his secretive employer earlier this week.
My name's Adam Libor. I'm an author and a journalist. I've written a book called Tower of Basel, The Shadowy History of the Secret Bank That Runs the World, and it's the first investigative history of the Bank for International Settlements. The BIS is a really fascinating institution, and in one line, it's the most important bank in the world that you've almost certainly never heard of. I'm interested in how power is exercised in the world and the role of international institutions. I've previously written a book about the UN and its failure to confront or deal with genocide. The BIS grew out of the same kind of era, in a way, as the United Nations. The BIS was founded in 1930, ostensibly as a means to manage German reparations payments for the First World War, i.e. the financial penalties imposed on Germany for the First World War. But the real reason the BIS was founded was to have a place where central bankers could meet outside the supervision of politicians and away from nosy journalists. The BIS was founded by an international treaty, which means that it's similar to the United Nations or a foreign embassy. It's technically extraterritorial in Switzerland. The Swiss authorities, although it's based in Basel, the Swiss authorities need the permission of the bank's management to enter the bank, and its assets can never be seized, even during times of war. It can't really be sued under any international Swiss law, and the management enjoy a number of similar privileges to diplomats.
The Swiss authorities, if they need to have permission to actually even enter the premises, then that isn't really a part of Switzerland, Adam.
No, it's not. I mean, and I tried quite hard to find out the exact legal niceties of this, but the bank wasn't particularly helpful. But as far as I could see, I mean, they did send me a copy of the treaties that founded the bank and the 1987 agreement with Switzerland. But as far as I could see from reading it, it means that, yes, technically, it's the same as an embassy. Or the United Nations is legally an international body. But it's also a commercial bank, and it only has 140 customers. Mostly they're other central banks, and it makes the profits tax-free. It was founded in the 1930s at a time when the League of Nations was active, when there was this sort of idealism that, you know, nationalism had led the world to the horrors of the First World War. So transnationalism and supranational institutions were really the way forward.
One of the things I found fascinating looking at this bank was that for many years it was very anonymous. After the Second World War, it seems there was a certain amount of embarrassment, and that they were actually, even though they were one of the most powerful banks in the world, based with an anonymous door, and the bank was based over the top of a chocolate shop opposite Basel Station.
I mean, the bank was very anonymous before World War II. The idea, you know, this was a different age when the elites and governments and powerful people weren't really interested in being accountable. There's something of that spirit still continues. I mean, nowadays, every 2 months, the 60 big central bankers of the world meet there. People like Ben Bernanke from the Federal Reserve and Mervyn King and his successor, Mark Carney, to discuss the global economy. And someone who's been to one of those meetings gave me a great quote. He said the main topic of conversation in those meetings was the stupidity of finance ministers and the quality of the wine. So you can see that that very elitist approach continues.
Now, you said that there are 60 banks, central banks, that sort of go there and meet, but there are 120 customers. Can you give us an idea of who those customers are?
The bank doesn't say who its customers are, and this is a big contradiction. I mean, we can guess that they're mostly central banks. I think most of the central banks of the world have an account there. Probably some international organizations as well. I would believe that the International Committee of the Red Cross does as well, because I found some documents in the BIS archives showing that they had dealings with the ICRC during the Second World War. But, and this is the problem, you see, because the BIS says it's an international institution with a mission of public service. Well then, who are your customers? What are you doing for them? But central banks are not commercial organizations. They're managing public reserves. And this is why the secrecy that surrounds the BIS is so problematic. Because when the bankers meet there every 2 months, there's nothing released. There's no press release. There's no agenda. There's no minutes or anything of the discussions. Even though the people that go there are public servants, we're paying their salaries and their plane tickets and their pensions. And yes, we need some more information about what's going on at this bank and what the kind of discussions are taking place there. It's a meeting place for the central bankers. And during the crisis, it's been a very important meeting place. I had an interesting interview with Sir Mervyn King, and he said that, you know, this is a place where they've been able to discuss the different policies and the different mechanisms by which they can deal with the crisis. And so the BIS is more a kind of forum for that and doesn't have an actual management role. And I'll give it some credit. During the mid-2000s, the BIS was one of the few organizations who was actually warning and saying, look, guys, there's too much money sloshing around here, and it's all going to end rather badly. So their predictions have come true. But I think the point is that we need to know much more about these discussions and what and who's there and what they're talking about, because these are public servants. And so it's a contradiction to have the confidentiality of a commercial bank but the privileges of an international organization. I think you're either one or the other. I mean, this is one of the strange things about the BIS, is that it really operates under the radar. Now, we'll give it credit. It has a website, and on the website you can get the annual report, and it does have some information about how it works. But journalists don't seem to have picked up on it, and I think you're completely right, because Mark Carney has been a pivotal figure at the BIS. He's a former member of the board of directors. He's a chairman of the Financial Stability Board. Now, what the Financial Stability Board, which most people have never heard of, is actually a very crucial, comparatively new international organization. And it aims to coordinate regulatory and supervisory bodies
for central banks around the world, in either in other ways to try and, you know, avoid the kind of mess that we've got now. And Mr. Carney was also chairman of the Committee on the Global Financial System, another thing which most people have never heard of, which is hosted at the BIS and issues policy recommendations to central banks. So Mr. Carney is clearly a very important person, and his CV in these areas, I think, is actually much more interesting than his record as governor of the Bank of Canada, because this is a good way to go in to say, you know, well, what are these organisations? What's their mandate? How do they work? What kind of things gust there?
Financial stability has not been happening, and the policy reacting to the problems with the financial crisis in 2008, which they've been developing at BIS, which Mark has been developing, neither does that seem to have really been working.
Well, I think you're highlighting an important issue here. I mean, where does the power of central banks come from? Now, obviously, in a democracy, you can't have the government telling the central banks what to do all the time, you know, boost money supply, cut money supply, you know, because they could, for example, engineer a mini boom just before an election by playing around with the money supply, and central banks have to have some degree of independence. But on the other hand, I think we need to know much more about how they're operating. And central banks themselves are more transparent than the BIS. You know, they do, the Bank of England does release some minutes of its discussions, so does the Federal Reserve. But it seems like when they get to the BIS, the door shuts behind them, they've got all these legal immunities around them, and they're suddenly on kind of protected international territory, and we don't know what's going on there, and we should.
What about the assets of the bank? Do we know how wealthy it is?
Yes, it's extremely wealthy. I mean, its profits for last year were more than $1 billion a year, tax-free. Those are distributed, some in dividends, some go back into the bank. So it's you know, regarded as one of the greatest places to do business with. It does provide a service as well. Say, if you're the governor of the Central Bank of Botswana, Estonia, you're unlikely to have the level of skills in asset management and liquidity supply that they can offer you at the BIS. So it's, you know, it provides a service to these banks, and it has a lot of gold. The most recent statistics I had showed that it had around 119 tons of gold, which makes it the 30th largest holder, around the 30th largest gold holder of gold reserves in the world, but more gold than Qatar or Canada. And it's a very, very rich institution.
At what point did money stop serving the populations and the people, and what point did it turn around where people started serving the money system?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I don't think there's like any one kind of day when that happened, but I think if we talk about Britain, I think clearly there was a big shift in the Thatcher era and the immediate post-Thatcher era, and it's perhaps related to the Big Bang as well, where, you know, the acquisition of money and the glorification of financial services happened, and, you know, which led in part to the wild housing boom that's going on, and the fact that, you know, it's a good point you raise. I mean, the fact is, if you're a university student now and say you want to become a teacher, unless your parents, you know, got the bank of mummy and daddy, you're extremely difficult for you to ever to be able to own your own house. And I think a part of that is related to the amount of money, you know, there just seems to be so much more money sloshing around the world.
It was decided at Bretton Woods to close the bank down. Why was that?
Because it was seen as something that was helping the Nazis, as indeed it was. The BIS accepted looted Nazi gold, and the BIS did foreign exchange deals for the Reichsbank, and it was so helpful to the Reichsbank, the Nazi central bank, that Emil Poole, the vice president of the Reichsbank and a BIS director, said that the BIS was the Reichsbank's only foreign branch. So all of this was being watched in the States, especially by Henry Morgenthau, the Treasury Secretary, and his assistant, Harry Dexter White, and they pushed very hard at Bretton Woods for the bank to be closed down, and although it was agreed that it would be, no date was set, so it never happened.
Well, that's so interesting, strange, isn't it? Absolutely fascinating. Martin, the bank shouldn't exist. It was an attempt to close it down after World War II by the Americans. In fact, they passed a resolution at Bretton Woods saying we've got to get rid of this bank because it was funding Hitler.
Yes, but what happened subsequently is that they thought Stalin was more of a threat, and therefore what the ex-Nazi structures, whatever they were integrated into the Western structures. So through Operation Paperclip, lots of ex-Nazis ended up living in Latin America, and that was winked at by the Western intelligence services, because the game had moved on, and suddenly we're not fighting the Germans anymore, so the Bank of International Settlements stays as part of our team.
Well, we've heard of the IMF, International Monetary Fund, we've heard of the World Bank. Why haven't we heard of this bank, the BIS, Bank for International Settlements, which is actually far more important as a meeting place and a policy making place for all the central banks of the world?
I don't think it's clear who actually pulls the strings behind these opaque structures.
Well, Mark Carney is pulling the strings. He's chairing the Financial Stability Board, which is looking at basically drawing up policy. Another policy making body, the Committee on the Global Financial System, he's also chairing that.
Well, more importantly, he used to be a Goldman Sachs partner, like all of them, and that's what people have got to recognise, is that we've got the intertwining of private and public interests here. And when our correspondent there was saying, well, you can't have central banks run by governments because governments might want to stoke up mini booms to get elected and so on, well, that's what used to happen in Britain, whether it was the Conservative or Labour Party in power. What they tried to do was engineer a mini boom before elections. It was normal practice. Now, of course, you could argue that that's bad practice, but it was normal practice in the past, where it was the Bank of England was only made independent by Gordon Brown. Before that, it had to obey orders.
Well, these central bankers, one of the things we know they're talking about, we're not allowed to know anything else, but one of the things Adam's found out, Adam Libori was speaking to me from Hungary earlier this week there, the stupidity of the finance ministers and the quality of the wine. Well, hang on a minute, but those finance ministers are there to represent us, not them.
Well, this is the problem all through the whole system, isn't it? Is that there are two constituencies that people in power are dealing with. One is the general population, who they have to keep happy somehow or other, and the other is the people with the money, who are the people who really call the shots.
So
they're constantly being pulled in two directions.
So are these people, the central bankers meeting at the BIS in secret, are they public servants or not?
Well, they're public servants who also work in the private sector and go back to work in the private sector and so on. So in actual fact, the interests they represent are not those of the community at large. Perhaps we should nationalise the whole lot and make the banking sector run by and for the community.
Anyway, that book is out last week. It's called The Tower of Basel, The Shadowy History of the Secret Bank That Runs the World, The Inside Story of the Central Banker's Secret Bank, by Adam Libor, L-E-B-O-I, was speaking to me there early this week from Hungary.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Well, 6 months on, it's time now to catch up with Filton aircraft engineer John Hart, who managed to find a farm to carry on his work since he was kicked out of his Filton hangar by the owners BAE Systems at the end of last year when they closed Filton Airfield. And he tells me not everyone has been so lucky. We start this, if you're in the car or something, you can turn your speakers up a little bit, because we start this with one of the aircraft that John has been repairing. That's a World War II Mustang, so stand by for that.
My name's John Hart, and I'm a licensed aircraft engineer. And we're at the moment at Manor Farm, East Garston.
Now, this is a little way from Filton, isn't it? How did you cope after Filton closed?
Well, we didn't have much of a chance to do anything other than cope. We've been working with Rob's for many years. He's always had this private airfield here. It's too far away to obviously work from on a permanent basis, but temporarily the CAA is allowing us to do some work from here until we can get somewhere else, hopefully at Aston Down.
Now, just remind us of the sorts of aircraft you work on. We've got one behind us. It looks like some sort of World War II. Maybe it's got American markings on it. What kind of aircraft are you doing?
It's a P-51D, and it's a Mustang. And it is a genuine aircraft from the war, and it's the only one of its type. There's plenty of P-51Ds, but it's the only 352nd Blue Noser. We've done a few Spitfires, and the last one was a Mark 9. I've done a Mark 8 prior to that. I've looked after Mark 14, Mark 19, Yeah, as well as obviously looking after these vintage aeroplanes, I've got a JR 66 license, and I'm licensed on modern aircraft like Gulfstreams, A300s, A310s, Airbus. So
you're doing a bit of everything. What is it that's so different about doing these old World War II aircraft, John, and getting them up into shape?
Well, I think that the main thing that you get is satisfaction from it. It's not just a job, you do it because it makes a lot of people happy. Brings back a lot of memories for a lot of the older generation. And it's also intriguing to the younger generation because it's huge engines and lots of noise and very powerful and very fast. The earlier aeroplanes, like the Spitfire, were using a higher skill base, I think, than we have now. There were lots of drawings which you have to use, there were manuals, but the Americans were a lot more modern in their approach because this was the next generation on a Mustang. So they had proper illustrated parts catalogues and so on. Materials have changed in a lot of cases, but there are equivalents for all the materials they're made from.
Where do you get the spares from? Where do you get a spare wheel for one of these?
Well, you can get spares, but they're getting more and more limited. There are pockets of engineering where they are remaking parts. Undercarriage door for a Mustang is a very difficult thing to manufacture. It needs three presses to just make the depth of press for the inner part. But there's a firm in America that have got all the presses, and they make new wings.
The spare parts are still being manufactured, and that if you've got enough money, you could actually even think about putting a World War II aircraft together from scratch. Give us an idea of how much something like that would cost you.
If you were talking Spitfire, I guess you'd be talking for the fuselage, about 280,000. If you were talking wings, you're talking 450,000. The engine overhauled, about 90,000. Propeller, 25,000. And then, of course, you got a few ancillary bits and pieces, like all the plumbing, instruments, and various other bits.
With these vintage aircraft, classic aircraft, I suppose you call them, what sort of people own them and operate them?
Well, the sort of people who own them are usually enthusiasts who have to be very wealthy to be able to run the aeroplane when it drinks up to 150 gallons of fuel an hour, and insurances of £20,000 a year, and all those sort of things. And, you know, that's just some of the costs.
Well, they must hold their value, surely, a bit like classic cars.
They go up and down. I mean, they peaked at about 2.5 to 3 million for a Spitfire. You can now, at this moment, buy one for about 1.5 million. And it would cost you $1 million to make one, at least. So you're not doing it to make a big profit and a living out of it, because it takes years to do them.
You've not just got this Mustang, you've also got the Spitfire to look after. Yeah. How are you managing to cope? Because there's not enough room in this little hangar here for all these various aircraft, is there?
No, there isn't. What I'm at the moment is I've got a large amount of my stuff in storage. I've got this aeroplane here, which we can work on, which I've been given for a period permission to be able to go to my store and bring stuff to it. This doesn't fully comply with the approval, but the CAA know the situation we've been put in, along with other people also who are suffering the same problems. And I've got the aeroplane over at Cologne. I'm restricted on what I can do at Cologne as well, but it's all basically so that we don't stop dead while we get other contingency plans sorted out. But it's just been bedlam.
Somewhere like Kemble, that would be seem to be the obvious place. That's where the old Bristol Aero collection was. It now looks like it's been moving up to Filton. Can you not do stuff there?
I approached Kemble. We were looking for a small hangar area, similar to the one I had at Filton. We were looking at £1,000 a week, and there isn't that sort of money in doing aeroplanes of this sort of calibre. They're done for as a cottage industry. They're not a sort of primary airline or anything like this, so unfortunately they're just not affordable. I went to Gloucester Airport as well, and by the time we'd finished paying £1,000 a month to the rates, the rest of the other costs and insurances, we were still back to £1,000 a week again.
Are there others who are working at Filton that are in a similar sort of situation that you know of, John?
Yeah, Nick, who looks after light aircraft and helicopters, he's got some of his stuff at home. He's got some of his stuff at Kemble, most of his stuff at Henstridge. In fact, he's operating from Henstridge and he's got a hangar there, which means he's got several hours of driving every day.
Do you think there's others who may not have managed to survive the transition out of Filton?
There are several that haven't made the transition out of Filton and are now either on the dole or they're trying to do a different trade. Unfortunately, because if you weren't licensed or anything, you haven't got much else as an alternative in the area. There doesn't appear to be an awful lot of support. People love to see them, but when you actually have to find hard cash, then the interest dwindles.
John Hart there, I spoke to earlier on this week, speaking to me from the other side of Swindon. Now, Martin, it's been very, very difficult for many of the people that were working at Filton to find places. I mean, it's a bit of a special case because he's looking after vintage aircraft. But he was saying as well that the company that's based there that used to look after light aircraft, they're also homeless. And there's a whole collection who are homeless, some of whom have also had to go on the dole.
Well, I mean, we've debated this whole question of turning Filton Airfield into a bovis home free-for-all many times. It seems pretty silly. If you want to keep an aerospace industry, you need some basic infrastructure.
But it is
BAE Systems aren't bothered,
well, it's owned by BAE Systems, and they've obviously had a good look at the place and said it's worth much more as housing than it was as an old airstrip with people like John working there. I mean, you know, he's earning a living from it, but not a massive income. It's not, you know, very permanent. But the other thing is, by having to decant out of Filton, he's finding that the rents in places like Kemble are astronomical, and he's never going to be able to actually continue with the skill, you know, that he's got at the moment anywhere, it seems, in the local area. He said he's having some negotiations with the Aston Down Airfield, but he's having to do this massive long commute. It just seems that many of the people with skills at Filton have already been run roughshod over.
Well, yes, and we're talking, it's not just small companies like his. Think about Airbus and the implications for losing an airfield at Filton in the long run. If this was Germany or Japan, nobody would allow an airfield, which is basically a key resource for the aerospace industry, which has developed in Bristol over the years, to be built on for short-term profit. It's just typical of what goes on in Britain and everything that's wrong with the way we run things.
Well, it seems also that certainly the people I've spoken to that work at some of the big aerospace places up there, BAE Systems do have an office, with offices, but there's a big manufacturers such as Rolls-Royce, such as Airbus, such as GKN, that make hardware bearings and that sort of thing. If you talk to people privately, they don't believe that those industries are going to be able to continue there without the airstrip.
Well, exactly. I mean, and you've got to have some kind of industrial strategy. But the industrial strategy in Britain is let's get some property up on that spot. Let's try and get a property bubble going, which is what the government are doing with their their housing subsidies. And then we'll just make some money out of pushing money around, and we'll all go off to the Cayman Islands when it all crashes. You know?
Well, we heard earlier this year as well from one of the local councillors up there, didn't we, that Airbus had produced in their annual report a map of all their sites across Europe, and Filton wasn't on it.
Quite. And these are the implications of not having an industrial strategy. They don't run it like that in Germany.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
So have you, like me, had enough of shouting at your TV and radio when they talk nonsense? Well, enough of all that. Luke Radowski founded a little organisation in New York called We Are Change, which has spread to many parts of the world now. Really, all it's about is individuals picking up cameras and going and shoving them in the noses of the rich and powerful. It uses the internet to doorstep war criminals, banksters and others the mainstream media fails to interview. Now, I spoke to Luke a couple of weeks ago at the Bilderberg Festival, so let's have a listen to him now.
My name is Luke Radowski of WeAreChange.org, and I'm an independent journalist. We Are Change is pretty much a citizen activist collective of different people from all over the world, and instead of complaining and moaning about the problems in the world and how the mainstream media doesn't do their job, we take initiative upon ourselves to actually become the mainstream media, to ask the questions to our elected officials that will never be asked. It came from the Gandhi quote, be the change you want to see in this world. We take it literally, and we go out there and we question Bilderberg members, corporate heads, military members, and politicians about the issues that are most critically important to society, and that includes a lot of the things that you never hear on mainstream media, which is Bilderberg, which is things like the NDAA, which is all these secret laws that nobody else talks about. So we're pretty much an outlet for real information that's unbiased, that comes out live, raw, unedited to everybody. The NDAA is a law that Barack Obama specifically said he will not sign. He signed this law into effect, and this law pretty much allows the President of the United States to indefinitely detain, arrest, torture, and put away anybody he wants just on the suspicion of a crime. No court trials, no court date, no judge, no jury. Barack Obama has pretty much become judge, jury, and executioner, and you see that with his actions with the four now American citizens that he has murdered with his drone program, without a jury, without a judge, without any prosecution, without any legal standards at all. It was his call. Every Tuesday he decides who lives and dies and sends out drones all over the world. So the NDAA is a critical part of that law that allows him to do that. He passed it. There's a lot of shady business going around it, and it's a huge controversial law that pretty much usurps the U.S. Constitution.
Well, that's, I thought the U.S. was a democratic constitution. This sounds more like either a banana republic or some kind of fascist dictatorship.
It definitely does, especially when you look at what happens with Bank of America and HSBC in the United States when they were caught money laundering to drug cartels, even terrorists and banned nations. Eric Holder of the Justice Department just said they're too big to prosecute. We can't prosecute these guys. They committed horrible crimes. But in the United States, if you release information about these horrible crimes, like a case would be like Jeremy Hammond, a hacker who hacked into Stratford and released documents how this private intelligence agency was spying on activists and journalists. He released this information. Stratford doesn't get in trouble. Jeremy Hammond is now going to be possibly sitting in jail for the next 10 years. In the UK and in Ireland, the other Stratford hackers, they got time served. They got 12 months in jail when the court was still going on. But in the United States, you see this huge crushdown on any kind of hacker or any kind of liberator of information. What you see is big money, big corporations ruling everything and being allowed to get away with murder. Literally murder. People who highlight the murders, people like Bradley Manning, they're the ones who are sitting in jail for the majority of their lives. So it shows you what kind of state we're living in the United States.
Well, it's a bit frightening, isn't it? Especially as it's a massively nuclear-armed power. Where is the US heading as a nuclear-armed global superpower that's turning into a narco-state, Luke?
Well, it depends. A lot of information is coming out, even in the recent days with the Verizon hacking scandal, how the US government and Obama is spying on every single person in the United States. All these documents are coming out, all the illegal actions that the Obama administration has taken, and people are starting to speak out. It could change at any moment. Information's coming out every day, whether it's the AP hacking scandal or the IRS scandal when they pretty much just go after their political opponents. All this information is coming out. The internet is giving a viewpoint and a waypoint for pretty much liberty through information. Everything that's happening, it sounds very devastating. It sounds extremely depressing seeing what's happening in the United States, but the bright side of things is seeing how information is being liberated. All the things are coming out about the Obama administration, so I do see a lot of hope, and I think the people in America, they're slowly but surely waking up to all the atrocities their government is committing.
Now, We Are Change, great idea, but how on earth, Luke, do you go and find people like Henry Kissinger? Most of us would like to ask him questions. How do you actually get him in public? You know, this guy is like a little turtle under his shell most of the time. He hardly ever comes out in public.
He barely does, but when he does, I make sure to find him. And the way I do that is I spend the majority of my time just looking online, looking for events in New York City or even anywhere in the United States. And every month I type in Henry Kissinger events for that month, and I make sure to find him. I was able to find him three times. I made one video showing exactly how I did it, but it pretty much, if you're determined, if you're willing to work hard, you could find anything. I remember a couple years ago, I always wanted to have a conversation with Kissinger. I was dreaming about it. I was thinking about it. I was like, I need to confront this guy. I confronted other people before, but Kissinger is one of the most vile people in the world that needs to be confronted on his lies and all the horrible acts he committed.
Well, just tell us about some of those acts. Well, what was boiling up in your mind at this time when you're thinking that this is the guy I need to get to?
Memorandum 200, the declassified document that came out, how he was talking about depopulating third world countries, the horrible crimes in Cambodia, in Timor, in Chile. I mean, I could just go on and on and on. Even just a couple weeks ago, WikiLeaks released a document stating how Kissinger was bragging how the illegal we do immediately, but the unconstitutional will take a little bit longer. And that came out from you know, one of the meetings. And it's just so insane knowing that this man who has committed such vile acts, who's wanted for mass murder in different countries, still advises the Barack Obama administration. It came out in a recent talk by the Council on Foreign Relations. National Security Advisor O'Neill said he takes his daily orders from Henry Kissinger. So this man, he's 90. His birthday was last week on a Monday. He just turned 90. This man is getting away with all the horrible acts, and he still has a significant influence on our government. And people don't know that. People aren't aware of the shadowy figures behind our government, but they're here today behind us in the Bilderberg Hotel, and they're pretty much helping gain policies that benefits them. And if you want to see what benefits them, you just have to look around in society and see what's happening. And you can see so many problems. You can see so many things that are going wrong. And these people are just secretly sitting behind the scenes and are making all the decisions for themselves, for their own benefit. And it needs to stop. And then the only way to really stop it is to make people aware of it and to doorstep them and to look them in the eyes and let them know, look, we know what's going on. You know, and I hope, one thing that I hope my work does is show people that these people are just regular human beings. They're not powerful. They're not elite. They're not these huge, grandiose figures like people make them out to be, because they're really not. They're weak, pathetic human beings who cringe and like babble in their words and have food all over their shirts like Henry Kissinger did when I confronted him. They're regular, weak human beings who can't even have a conversation and get mad and flip out. They're equal as everybody else is. We're all human beings. We all, you know, use the restroom like everybody else uses the restroom. And I hope my work, what it shows is that there shouldn't be this mystique. We shouldn't be afraid of these people. We should understand that these people are in charge, but we have to take our actions and we have to make sure that we become proactive and not just reactive to everything that they're doing.
That was Rudowski from We Are Change. I'm Tony Gosling. You'll find this programme online, taking you straight to our page on the BCFM website, thisweek.org.uk. Thanks very much for joining us. Thanks to Martin Summers and to Mike Woollacott. We'll be back next week, 5 o'clock on Friday, with the Mayor.
Online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.